Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
Welcome, everybody. This is Dave Lichten. It's good to have you with us again on another broadcast. Today is Monday, August 30th. Again, we mentioned that at the top of the program, just so those of you that go back and are listening live to our listing on a downloaded basis, either through the streaming or through your favorite MP3 device, know which program you're listening to. Folks, we've got a good program today. We have a good program every week, don't we? I'd like to say that we think we do. But today we have a special guest, John Trosella, who is the former economist for the National Association of Realtors. He was the chief economist there for 10 years. He's going to be with us talking to us about the economy and foremost his perspective of what's going on in real estate and how it relates to us. I tell you, his segment that's coming up here in the Hot Topics segment, I'm looking so forward to. We've got so many great questions for him. A special thank you goes out to our sponsors, of course, and PMI, Del Mar Database, MortgageU, MBS Quote Line, Wetzel Trott, and, of course, Mortgage Banking Solutions. We thank all of you for the sponsorship of this program. Also, a special note out to our friends at AmeriCatalyst. They are having a special event that I want to alert all of our listeners to. On September 12th, 13th, and 14th in Austin, Texas, there will be the AmeriCatalyst.
It sounds like we might have lost Dave. Joe, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm on the line, and we'll just get into the market for today and the week, and we'll hope Dave can get back on with us here quickly. But Alice, I'll give you the update, okay?
All right,
that sounds great. There he is.
Hopefully you back, Dave?
Oh, can you hear me back yet? Am I back?
You're back.
All right, I love it when that sort of stuff happens. Technology, we're dialed in through Skype. But anyway, we're finishing up our segment about ready to dive into rates, but I want to put in a word for that event that's going on September in Austin, Texas, related to rebuilding the housing finance system. It's going to be a great conference. If you want to know more, go to the AmeriCatalyst website. It's called AmeriCatalyst, AmeriCatalyst.com, AmeriCatalyst.com. You'll read about all the details. Joe, let's get started right there.
Okay.
Sorry for disappearing on you guys.
Well, that's fine. I was picked up for you.
Well, you know what? You two are just great for that. I appreciate that so much. All right. Joe, take it away. Tell us what's going on in the world of interest rates.
All right. Today, we're up today. 12:30 seconds so far in the day, reversing some of what happened last Friday, and I'll get into that in a minute. But this morning, as part of the personal income report, CPE came out at a very tame inflation rate of 1.4% on an annual rate. Mortgage investors like low inflation, so that was helpful to MBS prices today. Last week was a positive week for mortgage rates, although it ended on a bit of a down note. But it was a volatile week. We've seen a good bit of day intraday activity and movement. It's been the market's been pretty reactionary. Tuesday, for instance, MBS prices improved on what we've all heard by now were very weak economic or existing home sales. That combined with which helped create, but combined with strong demand for the 2-year auction, were good for mortgage rates. Wednesday, as prior to the new home sales number coming out, just after it, MBS prices were pretty good and durable orders were pretty good. But later in the day, things turned around and couldn't maintain the great prices that they had had most of the morning. On Thursday was another good day for mortgage rates, strong 7-year auction, very good. Fannie Mae 30-year 4% mortgage-backed security reached an all-time high in price on Thursday, and Freddie Mac announced that mortgage rates for the week, the weekly average, were as low as they've ever been. So Thursday was the lowest it's been on record, followed by Friday, which wasn't so good. We lost about a half a point in price on Friday, mostly due to things that Fed Chairman Bernanke said in his speech to the group out in out in the mountains. I don't remember where they're meeting, but we'll get into that in much detail, I think, with John. But the point of Bernanke's speech and the reason it wasn't so good for mortgage rates was that the economists, I think, were expecting, and investors were expecting, him to get into things that were even worse than what where he said they were. I mean, certainly he didn't say they were awful, but the economic picture he painted was not quite as bad as everyone had expected. So, and he announced that the further stimulus activity would have to follow significant additional deterioration. So the economy, he reported, was not so bad, and as a result, mortgage rates rose, MBS prices fell. Don't know if I have you, Dave, or
yeah,
do I have you?
Okay. Still hopefully have it. Let's talk about what's going on this week.
Okay, good. Big event this week's non-farm payrolls. It comes out Friday at 8:30. Right now, the expectation is for a loss of about 120,000 jobs, but most of that's going to be government workers. I think some people are predicting a private sector job environment at about a break even. Still have a lot of those census workers that need to run through the process, and a large number of the 120 expected jobs losses will be from census workers. Tomorrow, we have Chicago PMI comes out at 10, and the FOMC meeting minutes comes out at 2. Those shouldn't, the meeting minutes pretty much have been hashed out. I think they're going to say that there's a good bit of disagreement among the Fed right now, and but we've kind of already been told that they were about 50-50 on whether to begin to buy, you know, use that money to reinvest in treasuries. So shouldn't expect much from that, but the Chicago PMI coming out on Tuesday at 10, and then ISM comes out Wednesday at 10, and then Thursday we have jobless claims and pending home sales. But the big event for the week is going to be Friday's non-farm payrolls. You know, mortgage rates right now, Dave, are as I mentioned, are just about near all-time lows. Last Thursday were all-time lows in rates. And you know, it's a reflection of the economic environment that shows very weak economic growth and very, very low inflation. I think most of the economic and the economists' expectations this week for data are going to be that they will show weak economic growth and low inflation. And certainly anything that were to be contrary to that would be a significant event. So it's an important time for everyone to keep up with economic announcements and the reaction to those economic announcements, and look very forward to hearing John's perception on what he thinks those announcements are going to be. So I'll conclude with that, with great anticipation for the discussion later in the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe. I was on the Fox again this last week talking about interest rates, and I'm talking about a 30-year fixed rate below 4%, and it just raises so much you know, concern out there. So are we going to really go that low? It's kind of like the limbo game. How low can you go? Joe, thank you so much for bringing us interest rates each and every week. Folks, we'll be right back after this brief word.
Economic uncertainty has created a tremendous amount of market volatility for the past few weeks. Intraday price changes seem the rule rather than the exception. Have you been surprised by a midday price change? Have you been frustrated as you locked a loan just ahead of a price movement? Found it difficult to explain to a customer why the rate you quoted is no longer available? MBS Quoteline can eliminate these frustrations. MBS Quoteline monitors Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae mortgage-backed security prices in real time. It makes the information conveniently available on your desktop, smartphone, or by email or text message. These are the same prices used to set mortgage rates each morning and to issue midday price changes when significant movement occurs. With MBS Quoteline, you'll never be out of touch with the market, whether you're in the office or on the road. See for yourself what MBS Quoteline can do for you. Go to MBSQuoteline.com to start a risk-free two-week trial. MBSQuoteline.com. 646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dave Lickin. It's so good to have you with us. I tell you, this next segment, or one of the segments we got coming up here shortly with John, is going to be so interesting. But each and every week we bring you, or we don't, Alice does. She and her team, thank you so much to her team as well. Special acknowledgement to your team, Alice, for all the work that they do to keep you up on all that's going on. But we just appreciate each week you bringing us the legislative update, as also referred to as the legislative highway. Alice, good to have you on the program.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It does take a team of us at Mortgage U to be able to put all this together and track everything going on. And, you know, we've spent so many weeks following various pieces of legislation. I thought I'd take the opportunity in this segment that since Congress is in recess, to go ahead and focus on the proposed rules and final rules that are out there that we all need to watch. These are actually a little more what I might call treacherous and more immediate, because the rules process works much faster than going through the entire bill process through the House and the Senate and so forth. So I want to give everybody an opportunity to catch up on some of this aspect of the pending challenges we have ahead. First on the list is our RESPA required use definition. Now, the comment period for this expires September 1st, so this week, right? We're going to be looking at that no more comment period. Now, there was one last piece of RESPA, if you can go way back in your memory banks, that was trying to define whether or not it was a problem within RESPA that the builder-owned mortgage company, you know, the compensation and the discounts that go between builder-owned mortgage companies and the builder. For example, if you use my mortgage company, you'll be able to get a discount from the sale of the house. That aspect of required use being prohibited was, with the HUD was trying to find some wording for that. Well, it got pulled back. There weren't a ton of comments on this, and it's about to expire. And when I read through the comments, it literally was split down the middle. If it was a builder responding, they said this is great value for the customer. If it was a competing mortgage company putting in a comment, they were saying, this is unfair. You can't only give a discount if someone only uses your mortgage company. So that's all still up in the air, but the comment period is going to close here in the next day. The one that people have talked quite a bit about, I want you to picture and list back at the end of last year, we talked a lot about this huge Reg Z proposal that had many parts to it. We zeroed in on our show a lot about the loan officer compensation. So that now is its own standalone, what they're actually calling a final rule. It still technically has some processes to go through, but the Fed has published a final rule for the loan officer compensation that would prohibit compensation based on the terms and conditions. And this really just applies to table-funded originators. When you read the definition of originator, it also prohibits steering a customer. And the only safe harbor to say you're not steering a customer is if you've offered them a program with the lowest rate and the lowest fees, and it didn't have a prepayment penalty or negative amortization. And that's not an easy safe harbor to guarantee. So the loan officer compensation and steering has a published date coming up here. We don't actually have it. I haven't had a chance to check today. We'll check and follow up with you on an exact published date next week. But they're trying to implement this for applications as of April 1st of 2011. So this is right around the corner. It's going to feel like around the corner. Another part of the rule, so this whole Reg Z piece from last year has two other parts. A brand new ARM disclosure is being proposed. It's got a lot more detail on it. It's going to give the customer worst case scenario and a much more detailed table of how the payment stream is going to work. So loan originators, you've got a whole new form you have to learn how to explain to a customer, because the truth in lending disclosure is going to look a lot different for an adjustable rate mortgage next year. For that one, they're trying to get that one to be in place for applications as of January 30th. The other one that's a big surprise is the reverse mortgage disclosure piece. This thing is 900 some odd pages. But buried in it is a piece for all mortgages. So within this, it's titled a reverse mortgage disclosure proposed rule, is a piece that says for all mortgage transactions that the borrower would be required to have the till for at least 3 days, and if they were to withdraw during that 3 days, they would get all fees refunded. So we're now faced with another new 3 days to monitor. And now there's a lot that goes up in the air. Would I start charging it? What if I charged an appraisal already? And I actually ordered an appraisal, and the customer got the till and withdrew within 3 days of receiving the till. I would have to refund them the money, even though I've expensed it. So this is a challenge, this verbiage, and it's under a Reg Z proposed rule. The published date, it's not out there yet, so we're working on tracking down. We'll give you a final docket number next week, and there'll be a comment period of most likely about 90 days once it actually gets posted. So stay tuned next week to hear more on that. There's also guidance for FHA. As you all know, that comment period is now closed for the HUD, for the seller concessions, and new LTV and credit score requirements. So we're just waiting for HUD to give us a response back on what's going to be the proposal for our seller contributions. Going to be limited to down to 3% or some other number, and we'll have to wait and see on that one. So we're monitoring that, but no word from HUD yet on exactly which way they may lean. So, Dave, that's our quick traffic report right now for proposed rules.
Very good. Very, very good. Appreciate it. That's interesting. Another 900 pages. How do your team have the time to digest all this? Folks,
well, you're doing part.
I'll tell you, to listeners, if you're trying to digest what's going on in each and every one of your shops, I mean, you know what? My suggestion is pass the word around amongst your associates and dial into our program each and every week, because Alice and her team are doing the work for you. It's a great job of concisely bringing it to us. Alice, thank you so much. Folks, we'll be right back after this brief word.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource, used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals, providing classroom and web-based delivery, and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record, performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees, both live and online, on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lincoln on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's David Lincoln.
A special thank you goes out to all our listeners. I'm looking at our panel, and we've got people dialed in from all over the country. Thank you so much for being a part of our program and letting us come in to your busy lives and come in and be able to provide you insights into what's going on. And our goal is to digest all that's happening across the country as it relates to mortgage and mortgage news, rates, legislative information, and bring it to you. And as we do each and every week, we also want to help you make money, which brings us to the Profit Doctor, Andy Schell, better known as the Profit Doctor as it relates to our listeners. Tell us about cash management, or another way to put it is growth can kill. Really?
Well, how can that be? Growth is good, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Dave, you've heard the saying, cash is king. Well, and this is always true, and you know the golden rule, which is he who has the gold makes the rule.
The rules, yeah.
It would be interesting to hear our guest today speak about the gold standard. But in mortgage banking, we always know volume drives profit. Assuming we've got good margins, assuming we're doing our loans well, making profitable loans, more loans mean more profit. So that's a good thing. So that means that if volume drives profit, then growth is good. Well, it sometimes isn't, and here's why. So what is not well known about this, Dave, is that growth can actually kill a company.
Yeah.
And here's what can happen. Here's what happens.
Hard to
actually,
imagine,
I discussed
true.
This at a seminar I was teaching in Dallas to a CPA firm who sponsored an event up there called Ken Hughes & Associates, Ken Hughes in Dallas, Texas. If you're looking for a CPA firm, they're a good choice. And here's what we were talking about. Here's some of the facts. Most loans close, you know, around the end of the month. From the 20th to the 30th or so was when most of the loans close. Now, another thing is that most warehouse line lenders have increased their haircut on the loans that they're willing to bank. So what that means then is that for each loan that's closed, a portion of the mortgage bank's cash is tied up in the funded loan. So after the end of the month, have all these loans closed, at the beginning of the month, we've got a bunch of loans that are sitting on the warehouse line with our money in those loans, and we're waiting for the investor to buy it. And when the investor buys it, we're going to get our money back, plus we're going to get our gain on sale back. So we're going to get a lot of cash when the investor buys the loans. So, you know, we're all good. Well, but what happens if the investors are slow to purchase? And what happens if you just added a bunch of branches, you had a bunch of extra cash, you added a bunch of branches, have all this volume coming in, all this extra profit that's coming in, and you fund all the loans, and it uses up a lot of your money, you're waiting for the investor to buy your loans, and if the investor is slow to purchase, and what happens on the 15th? You've got a payroll. You got a payroll on the 15th. Your money's tied up in your loans. What are you going to do? It's a scary thing. This is an example of where growth can actually cause a problem, because too much growth ties up cash, puts it on the line. Oh, my gosh. We had one client that came close to this happening. Thankfully, they were using our forecasting model and were able to anticipate this coming on. But you've got to have a cash forecast, because if you grow too much because you added all these branches, you can have your money tied up in cash, or your money tied up in the loans, not make a payroll, and you know what? You only do that once.
That's the business killer right there.
You know, the word spreads, missed payroll, employees aren't gonna care that you've got a lot of money tied up in your loans. They just want the money. And trying to leverage that money is almost impossible, because you've already leveraged to get the money to begin with to get the warehouse line. So, folks, you got to be careful. Growth is a good thing. If it's managed right, volume drives profit, and profit happens when you fund a loan, but you got to use your cash to fund it. So volume for volume's sake, growing and growing. If you're using your cash, be careful. Don't miss that 15th payroll. So that's the Profit Doctor for this week, Dave.
Yeah, profit. You know, everyone says, well, you know, volume is good. It is good if you do cash flow management. If you have any questions, folks, you need to give us a call. We'd be thrilled to help you build a financial model that helps you build that out. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with our special guest, John Trussella, right after this brief word.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success, Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging, financial and accounting services, or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Welcome back to the program, everybody. This is David Licken with Licken on Lending. We have a special guest. I'm very honored to have him, and a special thank you out to Howard Voiles of Housing Matrix for making arrangements to have John Trussella come on the program today. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dave. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you. Well, and you know what's going on with so much talk about a double dip in the economy, and in your perspective, I mean, we got a lot of people that pay a lot of attention to you. 10 years as a chief economist there at the National Association of Realtors. You know, I've been tracking you for a long, long time, John. You're one of the guys I respect. Are we going to see a double dip recession? What do you think?
Well, you know, economists love probabilities, and I think the probability of double dip has gone up, but it's still well short of 50%. My own view of the world is that we will continue to have unsatisfactory and slow growth through 2011. And my suspicion is that when we see these growth numbers begin to play out, they'll be closer to 1.5 to 2.5 than they will be to 3 to 4. This is going to be a very, very long, prolonged recovery back to where we were.
Hey, John, this is Joe Farr. What role in that growth do you see? How important will will the housing market and real estate be in attaining that kind of growth level?
Well, you know, real estate was the driver in the early part of the century, especially construction as well as home sales, and the ancillary expenditure goes along with it. But I think, quite honestly, right now, housing takes a back seat. We're talking about a lot of excess inventory on the market. We're talking about a lot of people who still are looking for the bottom of the market. We're talking about a lot of people who are deciding maybe renting is better than owning. So I think right now, builders are locked in place. You see relatively low activity. If you take away the tax credits, there really hasn't been much in the way of sales of previously owned homes. So what we've got now is a housing market that's not dead in the water, but certainly not an engine of growth.
Well, you mentioned the tax credits, John. Was that program overall a success in your mind? And I guess that answer will give me a clue as to how you might answer the next question is, will we see another one?
I'd say it was a success. The problem with saying anything is a success, like the stimulus bill or anything like that, is that success in this case does not mean a magic bullet. This was not the magic bullet to bring the economy back. The stimulus bill was not the magic bullet to bring the economy back, but they clearly helped. Both of them clearly helped. As far as whether there will be another tax credit, I think it's pretty well unlikely that there will be. I mean, you go for another tax credit, and you're beginning to stretch the credibility of that particular policy. And what you wind up doing is having the Christmas sale effect, where people don't go to the department stores until they see finally the 60% slash as opposed to the 40% slash in prices. And people are going to say, okay, I'm not going to buy a house because I know there's going to be another tax credit. I'll just wait for that one. So I don't think you're going to see another tax credit for quite a while, at least not certainly not anything near what we saw in November and April.
Yeah, that's such a good point, John. There's a lot of people are going, why get involved right now? And it almost seems like, and I appreciate your comment about this has been a success, and it has been a success to bring about some temporary relief. But I sometimes wonder if government involvement to this level and this degree is actually exacerbating the problem by having their involvement. And is it really, did it create a temporary situation? And will the current dip in home sales be temporary, or will it be? Is this really the future?
Well, you know, you really have to go back a long way if you're going to unwind government involvement in real estate.
Yeah.
You know, at least go back to FHA. You go back to the inception of the mortgage tax credit. I mean, real estate has always been a government-favored enterprise.
Yep.
And it's so intertwined that tax credit was merely more the whipped cream on the top of the sundae than it was the ice cream that makes up the sundae. That being aside, I think the real problem is you create expectations, and when you create expectations, people operate upon those expectations. You expect that Congress will pass a law and something will happen immediately. You expect that there will be a tax credit and the housing market will all of a sudden come back. You expect there will be a stimulus bill and all of a sudden the economy will be healthy. The expectations which are created by the actions here are going to determine people's behavior, and they're going to determine people's evaluation of what the success of the policy was. It's pretty clear. And I think as far as the real estate market is concerned, people do not necessarily see the tax credit as a success because they expected it to do much more than it did.
Yeah, and I think that it's the whole expectation of what was this going to achieve. And I think we've got a deeper hole from an economic standpoint that we're trying to dig out of. One of the concerns, I actually heard someone actually say that home ownership is going to be on a continued decline in this nation. I found that troubling. What's your thoughts on the future of home ownership?
Well, the interesting thing is there's this continuing rent versus buy debate.
Yeah.
And if you look at the rent versus buy debate, it's not a national issue. It's a local issue. It makes far more sense, for example, if you are in a small city in the Midwest to own a home than it does if you're living in San Francisco. So your own calculation depends upon where you are living. Geographically, for the vast majority of this country, owning will always trump renting. But there will be significant numbers of people who live in markets where renting trumps ownership. And so it becomes a very much localized issue. And there is no one single guideline. You can say, oh, yeah, now it's better to own or now it's better to rent. It doesn't exist.
It's purely
conditioned on where you live.
Yeah, it doesn't exist nationally. But that's a great, great point. Dive into some of the things why it may – let's use San Francisco, for example. You brought that up. That's a great market, and there's a lot of people coming and going. I look at the tech industry, and I wonder how much the need for people to move, to stay employed, to shift the population shifts and moving, if that's going to be one of the factors that are going to be contributing to why it may be better to rent in one particular place, even if you're paying way more and not justified per se. Do you think that employment and the shift, people needing to move around to keep themselves employed, is a factor?
There is a theory that says that the more home ownership you have, the harder it is to adjust to changing labor market conditions.
Yes.
And there's a lot to be said for that. But if you look at a place like San Francisco, where you have a very high-priced housing stock, and you have a relatively transient population, young people moving in and out, you're going to find that it will make sense for a greater percentage of the population to rent in a place like San Francisco for those conditions. You go to a place more like, you know, St. Louis, for example.
Yeah.
St. Louis is a place where there's a lot more stability. The prices are lower. And remember this now. Home prices can go up much more than income can go up.
Yeah.
So
as we saw in our last cycle, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the price of a house in San Francisco may be nine times the price of a house in Peoria, but you're not going to find people making nine times as much money.
Yeah.
So what happens is, in the very high-priced markets, renting becomes more and more of a feasible option than it does in the lower-priced markets. You go to a place, as I said, like St. Louis, large metropolitan area, lower prices, a better price-to-income ratio, makes more sense to buy than to rent.
John, it's so good to have you on the program. You're talking about this. We're going to be right back after this quick break, and we're going to have John Trusella, who is the former chief economist for 10 years for the National Association of Real Estate Realtors, talking to us about what his views are as it relates to our economy. Great conversation. Folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
It's time for the Mortgage Minute with Rob Katz of Del Mar DataTrack.
Hey, the first article I want to mention comes from Barry Reitholtz. He posted a brief history of the mortgage interest deduction on his blog, which you can find at www.reitholtz.com. He did some research and explains how it is that interest on a mortgage became a tax deduction, and it isn't to encourage home ownership. In fact, when the rule was put into place to allow interest on a loan to be deductible, most people didn't even have a mortgage. It's a quick and informative read. Diana Olick published a story on CNBC.com about the recent activity around potential mergings of several home builders. Unfortunately, she links this activity to the belief that builders thought that they had hit the market bottom, but now no longer feel that way. Rather than trying to ride out the storm, many see the need to merge as the only way to survive what's coming. Yikes, let's hope she's wrong. You can read her article called Time for Home Builder M&A at CNBC.com. And finally, David, I enjoyed Kenneth Harney's post that recapped a couple of the leading economists from our industry at RealtyTimes.com. He highlights how both Doug Duncan, Fannie Mae's chief economist, and David Crow, the National Association of Home Builders chief economist, both recently stated that favorable home buying conditions are taking shape for consumers. He explains their position as a combination of consumers lowering their debt burden while interest rates remain historically low. Then add on the fact that, according to CoreLogic, home pricings are stabilizing. And you can understand why Mr. Duncan and Mr. Crow feel like they do. Let's hope they're right. You can read this story called Real Estate Outlook Fannie Forecast at RealtyTimes.com. Those were the stories that caught my attention this past week. This is Rob Katz with DMD, and I'll be back next week with the news I think you should know about.
This has been the Mortgage Minute with Rob Katz of Del Mar DataTrack. Catch Rob's news of the week right here on the Lincoln on Lending Show or online at DMDinc.com.
PMI Mortgage Insurance Company is the clear choice for your higher LTV conventional borrowers. Unlike FHA, PMI offers a choice of flexible premium plans to fit the individual needs of each borrower. From a one-time upfront cost with no renewal premium to a monthly plan with no upfront charges, PMI's premium plans recognize larger down payment and good credit history, saving your clients what can at times be thousands of dollars. PMI also provides lenders with fast electronic submission tools to increase efficiencies. Mortgage insurance is more relevant than ever, so it's important to utilize a mortgage insurer who's committed to the business for the long term. It is vital that you work with a company whose core competency is credit risk management and bring that wealth of knowledge to your firm. At PMI, mortgage insurance is their only business, so they have to get it right. PMI's mission is to create sustainable homeownership opportunities. To learn more about how PMI solutions can assist your business, please contact your PMI representative today or call 800-966-4PMI, 800-966-4PMI.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Dave Licken with Licken on Lending. We have as our special guest John Trussello, who is formerly the chief economist for National Association of Realtors for 10 years, and he's got his perspective, and I want to invite Alice and Andy, Profit Doctor, to come in and enter into the discussion with us. I'm sure you've got a few questions, as we have something with all that's going on in the economy, Alice. You just know it has got to be in the forefront of people's minds here.
Absolutely, Dave. Well, and John, welcome to the program. It's great to have you. And I have to say, I'm very excited to hear you talk about regional issues because, as these guys know, that's one of my hot buttons living here in the suburbs of Detroit. Because when people talk about double dip, over here in Michigan, we go, "What double dip? We never got out. What do you mean?" We're still down here. So I guess, you know, one of my questions for you is, you know, we saw so much talk when this was starting about Florida, Arizona, Nevada, California, you know, the whole sand state issue. Does it seem like this? Are those states influencing the numbers as people thought we were coming out of this? You know, so I'd like your perspective on that a little bit more.
Well, let me talk about that in a couple of different ways. Number one, they definitely influence the building industry because these are the places where builders, the big national builders, went to sort of lay down their product. And it's been that kind of mass production that has gotten them in trouble and basically stalled them in the water. So, yeah, that's very much a Nevada, Arizona, Florida problem. As far as the economy as a whole is concerned, it's more perception than it is reality. I mean, when you come right down to it, at least two of those states, Nevada and Arizona, are relatively insignificant in the greater scheme of the economy. I mean, you know, they're not very big. Their industries are not very large. And basically, you're really not talking about them in terms of large employment centers. Florida is a slightly different issue, but it's not necessarily large employment as it is large numbers of in-migrants. So as far as that's concerned, it's really a perceptual issue. We see what's happening down there. We say, oh, am I next? Where am I going? You know, the sky's falling, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as substantively, they're not really that much of an influence on the economy as a whole. I mean, I regard your area of the country, Alice, as probably more of a core substantive economic issue than I would the places where we had housing booms.
Hey, John, this is Andy Schell. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you on. I have a couple of quick questions. You mentioned the relationship between St. Louis and San Francisco, and I think you said San Francisco is roughly nine times St. Louis. And
well, actually, I said Peoria, but that's, you know.
Oh, there you go. I've actually
six times St. Louis.
Six times. Well, I've actually experienced that, having spending time in Reno and now in Austin, Texas. And used to be there was a pretty substantial relationship where Reno, Sacramento was a lot more than Austin, Dallas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was just looking at some house listings, and I couldn't believe it. I saw homes on a square footage basis less in Reno than in Austin and Dallas. I couldn't believe it.
Sure.
Do you see that as something that's going to continue for a while? When's that going to adjust?
Here's the key to understanding this. If you look at where local economies are based, you find four kind of almost recession-proof industries. And whenever you have three or more of those, you're usually in pretty good shape. And Austin is one of those places that has them. And they're essentially education, healthcare, government, and distribution. My poster child for this is Columbus, Ohio. If you look at Columbus, which has all four of those industries as the pillars of its economy, you're basically talking about a metropolitan area which has not gone through significant problems, no matter what the economy is. So Austin falls into that category. You look at a place like Reno, and you just simply don't have that kind of base which you have in a place like Austin. Yeah, you've got a university there. Yes, the state capital is not too far away. There's a medical establishment, but the fact of the matter is that it doesn't have them with the kind of intensity you have in Austin or Columbus, Ohio, or a lot of other places which have pretty much soldiered through this rough period. And I think that's what you have to look at locally as far as your long-term stability.
So polishing up your crystal ball, and no one will hold you to this, when do you see a place like Reno, Nevada coming back, prices improving again?
Yes. That's my crystal ball just said. I shook it up and said yes.
Sometimes.
I like that.
Ask again later. It's a magic eight ball.
That's funny.
You know, the quick answer to that is when they come back with dollar craps, Reno will come back. Now, I think the issue is this, and I'll get back. I'll put this within the context of the general economic problem, which of course is jobs. In the late 90s, we had an engine of growth that was called technology. In the early 2000s, we had an engine of growth that was called real estate. Now that we're entering the second decade of the 21st century, we have no engine for growth. So I can't tell you when a place like Reno will come back, because unless you tell me what the engine of growth is going to be, now I don't see it. I just don't see an engine of growth. We're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot in a lot of cases, but the fact of the matter is there's no clear-cut technology or real estate leading the pack, employing people and building up local economies. And until we get that, we're just going to muddle along, which is why I said at the beginning it's going to be a low growth, very dissatisfying environment for the foreseeable future.
Very slow slope out of this deep trough we're in is what I hear you saying there. Because
I'm not that pessimistic.
Okay.
I'm just saying wherever we are, wherever you happen to be, you will be improving, but it's not going to be improving enough for you to be satisfied.
And it's going to be a regional improvement is what I hear you're saying, John.
I think in some areas you will see faster improvement than others. But for a national improvement, for a big national growth spurt, we really, really need to find an engine of growth which will produce good jobs with long-term prospects.
You know what? A lot of people I do a lot of television. I'm on Fox a lot and get asked a lot of questions. And I keep coming across this. I hear some of the commentary. As a result of being there, I like to listen to the commentary, what others say. And I have to. It seems like I agree with this. Is that without job growth, can you ever have that? Whether it's job growth in technology or whichever sector might be growing and taking off, is it possible to have a recovering economy, a strong economy without job growth in some sector?
Yes, because you are going to get job growth in some sectors, okay? But I think that the key question is it a leading sector? Is it a sector that can provide long-term prospects for jobs, right? Is it a sector that adds value to the nation as a whole? You know, and I go back to the late 90s when we had when the economy was booming, when there was high employment, when we actually had, lo and behold, government surpluses. You know, I mean, geez. And that's the type of thing which would be sort of a model for what we're looking for. But what is that? And we don't have that. Now, having said that, the United States economy is big enough and complex enough that it's going to keep growing. In the current set of circumstances, it's going to keep growing. But, you know, as I said, without that kind of leading sector pulling along, the growth is going to be very, very slow.
One of the things that one of my economists I like to listen to, and you're one of the ones, but also I listen to a guy like Harry S. Dent. His book that he talked about, several people have written about the dynamics of the population, the aging population, the fact that the baby boomer is back downsizing in the homes, and that's entering in as a factor in many people's minds. I know Harry Dent talks about that a lot. What are your thoughts about, you know, the demographics of the aging population of the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I admire Dent as well. You know, he's not right every time, but you know what? Nobody's right every time.
That's right.
But I think he's got the general trend correct. And this is the thing that makes me optimistic about the U.S. economy, is that you have such a strong underpinning of population growth and dynamics. Right now, I'd say if you look at the longer scheme of things, you know, if you want to look at this from 30,000 feet, the economy right now is in terms of real transition, not in terms of transitioning from a manufacturing economy to a knowledge economy or technological economy, but rather transitioning among generations. And what you're seeing in a lot of cases is the inability of the baby boom generation to sort of bow out gracefully and give way to X and Y. And I think this will occur simply because of weight of numbers, and Dent is right in that regard. But you know what? Baby boomers are stubborn, and the more they attempt to hang on, the longer the transition is going to be. And believe me, the financial crisis we've just gone through has not made that problem any easier. It's made it a lot more difficult. Okay.
Having just turned 60 last week, John. I'm a part of that baby boomer group, and I see the reality is I enjoy working. So, and the reality is I may have to keep working for a while.
Welcome to the lifer club. but I also have to tell you that it doesn't matter whether boomers keep working or not. It's whether they can subordinate themselves to X's and Y's. That's really the issue. I mean, I love what I do, and I don't intend to stop doing it. On the other hand, I fully realize that, you know, it's not my world anymore. I'm just keeping it, preserving it for the people to come after me. And so, you've got to have that kind of attitude. And if you have that kind of attitude, that transition's easier.
Yeah, that's good. That's so point. Joe, I know you had a bunch more questions for our guest, John. So
I think one that lots of people out there are asking themselves, and that is just how low can 30-year fixed rate rates go?
In other words, how far off is the host?
I reported.
As a Wall Street economist once said, there's a lot of room between 3% and zero. I think that's kind of what we're looking at. Part of this issue is what are the banks doing with all this liquidity the Fed's pumped into them?
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're playing the short-term market, and that's adding to the fall in long-term interest rates. You know, I thought I was getting a great deal in 2003, and then when I refinanced again in 2009. On a house, which the interest rate on my mortgage was the same as my parents borrowed at in 1950. Okay, now that looks like a very expensive mortgage, and I'm looking at refinancing again simply to bring that payment down, and that in itself is a large boon to the economy. If it weren't for that a lot of housing values overroded and people can't refinance. If they could refinance, you're talking about freeing up a lot of money, which could support consumer spending, and that's a good thing. But I got to tell you that in this particular rate environment, I think they will still fall a bit more. Yeah. I think the lower they get and the lower the inflation numbers are, the closer we get to tipping into the Japanese model, into a long-term deflationary period. And while I don't see that happening, the probability of it is going up, and I think that's an issue we have to worry about a little more. My own personal preference is to worry a lot more about inflation than about deflation, but the evidence suggests that we're beginning to flirt with that.
Is it true to say that inflation is like a very bad disease, but it's not terminal? But deflation is, in fact, just can be so terminal to every economy.
Mm-hmm. I think basically the way I'd characterize it, inflation is a disease for which there is a known cure.
Yeah.
Deflation is a disease for which there is no known cure.
Yeah, great way to put it. I love that.
So it's a lot easier to deal with inflation. And I think, by and large, the Fed would rather see us perking along at 2 to 2.5% inflation than at 1% inflation or less. And I think that that's one of the issues they're grappling with right now. You know, there's a side which says, hey, look, there's $1 trillion of liquidity floating around the banking system. If that stuff ever gets out, we're going to have inflation. The other side of the coin says, but it's not getting out, and we're getting deflation. So, yeah. You know, it's a debate.
Well, John, hi, this is Andy Schell. I have another related question to what you were just talking about. You know, 35 years ago when I was in college, my finance professor told me that deficit spending drives inflation. Always will, and obviously that isn't the case, hasn't been the case. But, you know, we went from $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $5 trillion, $8 trillion forecasted, $41 trillion deficit, whatever it is. At what point does the deficit affect and override the current pressures to cause inflation to kick up into hyperinflation even?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a relationship that's automatic as long as you have a productive economy. You know, if you look at the great hyperinflations of history, they were basically generated by the complete stripping away of all productive facilities. You know, and that doesn't happen here. The fact that the dollar is a sovereign currency in the world also helps because people have to have dollars to do deals, and you know, we're the only supplier. So I think there are a couple things which keep that at bay. I think the real danger with inflation, the real danger with deficit spending is that down the line we don't have the wherewithal to make the investments we need to make to keep that productivity up. And I think that's what worries me more about deficits. I mean, when you think about the shape of the government budget going forward, right, you think about three huge categories of expenditure that are mandatory: Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. You know, let's assume we're going to maintain a balanced budget going out into the future. Those three categories alone are going to take up a huge amount of money, which means that the ability we have to improve education, to make investments in infrastructure, all the kinds of things which you kind of like to do to stay current in the 21st century, yeah, that's highly restricted now. And that's that I think is the worst outcome of the deficit that we in the United States can expect.
John, I want to just say what a joy it is to have you as a guest. As we close out this segment, help us. What should we be looking at? Us as real estate professionals, the realtors in our audience, the mortgage professionals in our audience, what should we be looking at economically to get some indication of where this thing's heading between now and the end of the year? What are the key things that are on your radar screen?
Jobs, period.
Jobs,
but even more importantly, it's local. It's local.
Ah.
And one of the things which I think people ought to understand is that it's not at all about the unemployment rate. You know, it's possible for this economy to remain in recession, or even grow. To remain in recession, I should say, and for the unemployment rate to drop overnight to 5%. And all that requires is that people give up and leave the labor force. All right. So the unemployment rate is not a good indicator. The best indicator is number of jobs created or lost in a given month, and that should be looked at as locally as possible. What is your market area? What were the jobs created or lost in that market area last month? And it seems to me, and you can find that on your State Department of Labor website, which accumulates it by counties and releases it about 2 weeks after the national number. So Friday we get the national number, and you look at that. And then 2 weeks later, you get your state number by county, and you look at that vis-a-vis your market area. That's really the key indicator. I think the other thing which you need to do is to, at the local level again,
yep,
is identify what the key economic drivers of your local economy are, and then regularly meet with people in those sectors to hear what they're seeing on the ground and what's happening in their area. And then you, from the mortgage or real estate side, trade with what you see happening in your area. So in other words, you create kind of a group intelligence that where in that group everybody kind of knows what the major economic drivers in this area are doing and they think are going to do. And I think that gets you a lot farther down the line than listening to me or any other economic spouter or looking at the national statistics. I mean,
yeah.
You know, because I can tell you a whole bunch of stuff, but if you call me up and say, hey, you know, I'm a mortgage broker in Plano, Texas.
Yep.
What's going to happen in my market? You know, I'll immediately start talking about baseball because I don't, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
So I think you have to watch your own market by yourself, and that involves, A, looking at job changes, and, B, talking to the people who represent the major economic drivers in your local market.
That's a great comment. I agree with that so much. John, you publish a newsletter. I know you're out speaking at people. Give me some feedback as to how, or tell our listeners how they can learn more about you, go and to read your commentaries and follow you more closely.
Well, you know, you can go to my website, which is www.johntucillo.com, which is T-U-C-C-I-L-L-O, and you can see a bunch of stuff. That's a little out of date because I've kind of moved away from the website and moved more towards social media. You can find me on Facebook. I haven't yet begun to Twitter because I found that I can't express anything in 140 characters or less. But, you know, I am on Facebook, and people can look for me there. My email address is Tumler, T as in Tom, U-M-L-E-R, at AOL.com, and I am available to speak or to consult. My major consulting practice is planning for trade associations and private companies.
John, thank you so much for being with us on the program. Again, our guest has been John Trussello, of John Trussello and Associates. And we just are so grateful to have you and your comments. I hope you'll come back and join us again. Appreciate it.
I am open to your invitation. I had a great time. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Thank you so much. Alice, Andy, and Joe, we've got ourselves another program coming up not next week, because guess what, everybody? It's Labor Day. So, but this program, Alice and Andy and Joe, I mean, I just can't get enough of this. I could have gone on for 2 hours listening to him talk. I have so many questions we wanted to ask, and my Twitter account's loading up with questions as well. So trying to Twitter, but he's right. It's hard to get a Twitter question in quickly. Alice, Joe, and Andy, any thoughts you want to add to this as we get to wrap up this program?
Well, I just wanted to throw in and really I loved what he provided there at the end about, you know, checking out your numbers at the Department of Labor,
yeah.
Meeting with people, because, you know, when you hear a national statement that prices are stabilizing, or if you're one of the ones who listens to a radio station that's sending you, you know, making you fearful that you need to build a bomb shelter, you know, I think he brought a lot of common sense and a lot of ways to really get a comfort level and that you can actually participate and take action at a local level.
Yeah, and that is the key, is you've got to start looking at the local markets. And you know what? I think we get so blinded by the big picture, and I just really, of all the comments John said, that's the one that I just locked in the most, and it's key. I mean, we got to have, in fact, we should have him back on, or we should be doing some research on what to help guide our listeners to where to get the data in the local markets. That'd be great. I'll tell you, it's good stuff. Andy, Joe, any comments as we close out?
Well, we're going to test how much room there is to go lower, it looks like. We're up 30 seconds on the day.
Yeah, I tell you.
Just
I think
a couple 30 seconds from the all-time high price for the four.
I stuck my big foot in my mouth out there and went on national television and said we're going to be below 4% on the 30-year fix before year end. I tell you, I hope I'm right for that standpoint, just so I can preserve my reputation. But
there
more importantly, I hope I'm wrong, because that means the economy might be recovering. We might be heading out of this finally. But it doesn't look like it. Folks, it's so good to have you be with us again. Check us out. Remember, we're not going to be here over Labor Day. Most of you aren't going to be working anyway, so it's probably okay with our audience be a little short that week. But anyway, have a great Labor Day, and we'll look forward to talking and having you back again the following week. The following week, we've got a special guest, Brian Roche, from his VP of PMI, going to be talking about the difference between conventional and FHA. Whether you're a realtor or a loan officer, you want to tune into that program. A lot going on there. Thank you again, everybody, for listening. Have a great Labor Day, and talk to you soon.
This has been Lincoln on Lending. a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Licken of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. On the web at www.mortgagebankingsolutions.com. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, delivering live mortgage-backed security prices as trades happen, and Alice Albee, President CMB of Mortgage U, your ultimate education and information resource. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.